waste? Nuclear industry spokesmodels and propagandists try to convince us that the radioactive disaster sites like Fukushima can be cleaned up in a matter of years, or at most decades. But when you hear a genuine expert on the issues, like Dr. Gordon Edwards, and he says about plutonium-contaminated nuclear waste...
Plutonium has a 24,000-year half-life, but when it disintegrates, it changes into another material which has a half-life of 700 million years. So we're talking really about eternity. I mean, for all practical purposes, we're talking about eternity.
Well, when you hear information like that, you know that you are stuck in the seat that we all share.
Nuclear hot seat. What are those people thinking? Nuclear hot seat. What have those boys been drinking? Nuclear hot seat. The corium is sinking. Our time to act is shrinking, but our activists are linking. Nuclear hot seat. It's the bomb.
Welcome to Nuclear Hot Seat, the weekly international news magazine keeping you up to date on all things nuclear from a different perspective. My name is Libby Halevi. I'm the producer and host, as well as a survivor of the nuclear accident at Three Mile Island from just 1 mile away. So I know what can happen when those nuclear so-called experts get it wrong. This week, we continue our interview with Dr. Gordon Edwards of the Canadian Coalition for Nuclear Responsibility. We cover shipping of highly radioactive liquid nuclear waste from Chalk River in Ottawa to the Savannah River site in South Carolina, over land, on highways, tracking through at least 6 states and 1 province. But hey, what could go wrong? We also discussed the proposed high-level nuclear waste dump Canada is still considering building only 1 mile from the shores of Lake Huron. But hey, what could go wrong? Plus, numbnuts of the week for outstanding nuclear boneheadedness, the duck and cover report on the latest problems with our crumbling U.S. nuclear reactors, plus news, attitude, and more honest nuclear information than Donald Trump Jr. talked about with the Russians, we think. All of it coming up in just a few moments. Today is Tuesday, July 18, 2017, and here is the week's nuclear news from a different perspective. Starting off in Japan this week, where TEPCO, Tokyo Electric Power Company, is playing PR ping pong with news about the release, non-release, later release, now release, well, we're thinking about it, release of radioactive water, 770,000 metric tons of tritium-contaminated water from their storage tanks at Fukushima Daiichi. On Friday, July 14, the new chairman of TEPCO says the utility needs to stop dragging its feet on plans to dump massive amounts of treated but contaminated water into the sea and make more money. Takashi Kawamura, TEPCO's chairman, said the decision has already been made. Well, maybe, maybe not. Ignoring for a moment the fact that the Pacific Ocean does not belong to Japan, but belongs to the world, pushback has come from Japan's disaster reconstruction minister and from fishermen in Fukushima. Both are concerned not for the health of the ocean or future generations that will have to deal with the contamination created by fish, plankton, all sea animals being exposed to this radiation, but with possible repercussions for fishermen based on the perception of damage due to unfounded rumors. That's a quote from the reconstruction minister. So it's not concern about the health of the oceans or the health of the people exposed to this radiation. It's all about selling fish, which is still banned in 33 countries around the world. Making matters worse, mainstream media has been picking up and repeating incorrect numbers as to the number of tanks and the amount of water. So I turned to some of the genuine experts within our own community to get a breakdown on exactly what TEPCO is talking about releasing. There are approximately 1,000 storage tanks at Fukushima Daiichi, each one of them capable of holding 1,000 cubic meters each. In May of this year, 56 old tanks were dismantled, the ones that were not welded together, and replaced with welded tanks. In all, 980,000 cubic meters, or metric tons, of contaminated water are stored in 980 tanks. In one type of water, only strontium has been removed, but not yet another 62 radio elements. In the others, strontium and the 62 radio elements have been removed, leaving only tritium, which there is no technology capable of removing tritium from the water. That's what they want to dump into the Pacific Ocean. 778 tanks of tritium water, each containing 1,000 cubic meters. This is different than the figure that has appeared in the media of 580 tanks. That's a typo. It's an echo chamber. Nobody's been checking their source material, except for the people at nuclear-news.net. And while there have been numerous posts claiming that TEPCO is going to dump, quote, all the waste at Fukushima into the ocean, that's not true. It's only the water, not sludge, not solid debris. It's not good, but it's not as catastrophic as the mistakes, the typos, and the echo chamber have been putting out. And right now, it's all on hold, if only for PR reasons. And TEPCO then announced on Monday, July 17, hey, we haven't made a final decision yet. Just joking. We'll keep you posted on this one. Meanwhile, TEPCO is cleaning up Unit 2 reactor building at Fukushima with a robot wielding a mop and a vacuum. I could use something like that at my place. Over to the U.S., where Energy Secretary Rick Let's Make Nuclear Cool Again Perry got a shock when a draft of his study of the power grid revealed that nuclear is uneconomic and that, quote, high levels of wind penetration can be integrated into the grid without harming reliability. This draft of the study, leaked to, among others, Bloomberg and Think Progress, debunks Perry's attack on renewable energy. Release of the study has been delayed several weeks, probably to scrub out the information the administration doesn't want to admit to. In North St. Louis, a Westlake landfill neighborhood group is calling on the state of Missouri to run tests to determine if rainwater runoff from the nuclear dump site has seeped into a pond where children swim and fish. Just Moms co-founder Dawn Chapman issued the call after recent tests by the Missouri Department of Natural Resources found radiation in the rainwater outside the landfill fence. Chapman said, the state's recent data that they collected from the stormwater runoff does not support the EPA's nor the owner's conclusion that this waste has stayed on site. It paints a very serious picture. Landfill owner Republic Services downplayed the report, saying that because the stormwater is, quote, not drinking water, then the radiation levels are, quote, inapplicable. What does a soul go for these days? The Colorado Health Department will study thyroid cancers near Rocky Flats after citizen concerns were raised. And a big twofer from the Nuclear Rubber Stamp Regulatory Commission. It has decided against fining a Wyoming uranium mine that spilled radioactive waste on U.S. Highway 191 south of Blanding, Utah last year. And the NRC's Atomic Safety and Licensing Board ruled that at Turkey Point in Florida, the risk of contaminating drinking water with a plan to pump wastewater deep underground would be a small risk. And they decided it's just fine for Floridians to face it. Duck and cover. NRC event reports. Waterford in Louisiana had an unusual event, which isn't all that unusual. And additional reports at Thermion, Michigan, Watts Bar in Tennessee, Oyster Creek in New Jersey, and Clinton in Illinois. And now,
Nuclear Hot Seat, Nuclear Hot Seat, Nuclear Hot Seat, none that's out of the week.
When it comes to failing upwards, the nuclear industry has got it all tricked out. Take Plant Vogtle in Georgia. Please, take it. Reactors 3 and 4 are more than 3 years behind schedule and $3 billion with a B dollars over budget. But as for the project's largest stakeholder, Georgia Power, its shareholder dividends are steadily rising, and CEO Tom Fanning received a nearly 34% pay increase last year to $15.8 million. How is that possible on a nuclear project that's $3 billion in the hole? Well, it turns out those costs are being passed on to Georgia Power customers each month in their power bills. The nuclear construction cost recovery tariff is about $10 per month on the average residential Georgia Power bill. The money goes towards the finishing costs of constructing the nuclear reactors, or so they say. But through December of 2016, the nuclear construction cost recovery charges collected have added up to nearly $2 billion. And some of that money goes towards Georgia Power's profit, which now exceeds, are you ready, $1 billion. Yet no word as to when those reactors are going to be finished, and reactors 3 and 4 combined have not produced enough electricity to light a single light bulb. But the company has still made its profit. And it's all perfectly legal, because in 2009, the Georgia Nuclear Energy Financing Act was passed, which allows utilities to collect the financing costs of nuclear power plants before the plant is completed. So let's face it, there's not a lot of incentive to get that damn thing built, because it's a cash cow that's just going to keep on giving. And it's the people of Georgia who are being milked. And that's why Plant Vogtle and Georgia Power and Southern Company, you combined, are this week's
Nuclear Hot Seat, Num Nuts of the Week.
We'll have our featured interview in just a moment. But first, I know that you care about getting honest, verifiable nuclear news. Otherwise, you wouldn't be listening to this show. That's what we set out to provide at Nuclear Hot Seat every week. Verifiable information, sourced and checked, plus interviews with people who are genuine experts on various aspects of the nuclear industry that the nuclear industry would rather you not know. In order to do this, we do incur costs, and that's where we need your help. In order to continue to bring you the most accurate information possible, please help us out with a donation of any size. Just go to nuclearhotseat.com and click on the big red donate button. And if you want a simple, inexpensive way to support the show on a monthly basis, we now have a big green donate button, which allows you to set up a recurring donation of $5 a month. Now, let's face it, that's the price of a cup of coffee with a decent tip to a barista. So buy Nuclear Hot Seat a cup of coffee this month, and consider doing it every month. Know that I am deeply grateful for whatever you can do to help us meet our expenses and keep Nuclear Hot Seat alive and growing and kicking nuclear where it's going to do the most good. Now for the interview. This week, we continue hearing from Dr. Gordon Edwards, who is president of the Canadian Coalition for Nuclear Responsibility and one of Canada's best-known independent experts on nuclear technology. Since he became involved with uranium issues in 1977, he has worked with the Canadian government, First Nations tribal councils, consulted with governmental and non-governmental bodies, and spoken internationally at conferences sponsored by Physicians for Global Survival, International Physicians for the Prevention of Nuclear War, Dr. Helen Caldicott, and many, 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 many others. The man's knowledge of nuclear issues, not just in Canada, but around the world, is encyclopedic. This interview concludes an extended talk we did on Canadian nuclear waste issues that impact us all. In part one, last week on Nuclear Hot Seat 316, we discussed the Chalk River facility in Canada and its current plans for building a five-story-high megadump to permanently dispose of more than 70 years of mixed nuclear waste. He had a lot to say about why that was a bad idea. Now, we cover the already begun shipments of highly radioactive liquid nuclear waste from Chalk River to the Savannah River site in South Carolina, only 25 miles southeast of Augusta and 150 miles from Atlanta. Then we shift to the ongoing push by Bruce Power and the Canadian nuclear industry to build a deep geologic waste repository for low-level and intermediate-level radioactive waste from all of Ontario's 20 nuclear power reactors, less than 1 mile from the shores of Lake Huron. Oh, Canada. Here's Dr. Edwards.
Then there's the matter of Ontario Power Generation's ongoing push to build a deep nuclear waste repository less than a mile from the shores of Lake Huron. I don't know what it is with Canada planning to put nuclear waste facilities so close to major bodies of water, but that's what is being planned right now. And certainly under Prime Minister Stephen Harper, it almost passed, but now there's a pause on it. I don't know for how long. Fill us in on what that situation is and where it stands now.
Well, this, again, is a situation in both cases, Chalk River and the Bruce site. If you look up in Georgian Bay and Lake Huron, there's a peninsula, which is called the Bruce Peninsula, sticking up on the Canadian side there. And right near the base of that peninsula is where, facing Lake Huron, is where the Bruce nuclear site is. Now, the Bruce nuclear site is the largest nuclear complex in the entire world, the largest operating nuclear complex. There are 9 reactors there. 8 of them are operating. One of them has been long shut down for decades. And they have also been routinely taking nuclear waste not only from these reactors that are on site, but also nuclear waste from other reactors located on Lake Ontario, the Pickering reactors, of which there are 8, and the Darlington reactors, of which there are 4, all of them right on the Lake Ontario. They've been taking the routine waste that are generated by these reactors in the form of low and intermediate level waste, and they've been trucking them up over highways to the Bruce site, where they have something called the Western Waste Management Facility. And this Western Waste Management Facility has been storing these radioactive waste for many years. Well, now we're getting to the point where these old reactors, they're all getting quite old, and the Canadian design is different from the American design. We have, instead of one large reactor vessel which holds the fuel, we have hundreds of individual pressure tubes which hold the fuel. And these pressure tubes become highly radioactive by neutron bombardment. When neutrons bombard non-radioactive materials, those non-radioactive materials become radioactive. In fact, many people may not realize that ordinary water, if you put ordinary water into a nuclear reactor core and let it sit there for a period of time, it will become radioactive, not because of contamination, but because the actual water molecules have become radioactive. And that's called tritium. The hydrogen atoms absorb an extra neutron and become unstable in their core, and they become radioactive forms of hydrogen called tritium, and that's where the tritium comes from. So we're producing tritium all the time in Canada and releasing it into Lake Ontario. The levels of tritium in Lake Ontario are about twice as high as they are in Lake Superior, even in the center of Lake Ontario. And that's because, largely because of tritium emissions from the Canadian reactors. The Canadian reactors produce much more tritium, about 30 times more tritium than the American reactors, for technical reasons. But what happens is that the actual structural materials also become radioactive through the same process of activation. It means the neutrons hit impurities in the zirconium and the steel, and that's where cobalt-60 comes from. People have probably heard of cobalt-60. Well, cobalt-60 is created by activation of non-radioactive cobalt, which is already present in the steel. So that all these radioactive materials are created right in the structure of the structural materials, and that's why decommissioning produces huge volumes of radioactive waste in addition to the irradiated fuel. Many people have the mistaken idea that if you take the irradiated fuel out of the reactor, then that's the radioactive waste and what's left is not radioactive. Not true. Everything that's left is radioactive, at least in the nuclear side of the nuclear reactor, the primary cooling system. Everything there becomes quite intensely radioactive and becomes radioactive waste. That's the kind of stuff that they have been transporting to the Bruce site And now they want to bury it right on that site. Why on that site? Because that's simple. That's where it is. And in fact, the reactors were built close to the lakes because why? Because they need large amounts of water to run. The heat that's generated by the nuclear reaction is so intense that you have to have huge volumes of water pouring through those reactors just to keep the fuel from melting. And that's why they build the reactors close to these water bodies. And then, of course, it's a matter of convenience for the nuclear industry to simply abandon the waste right where they were created. And that's why, in Canada, we are facing this situation where they are talking about abandoning nuclear waste right beside major water bodies, which is totally against common sense, let alone any kind of sense of long-term ethics or scientific planning. You know, the Great Lakes themselves are only about 10,000 years old. They were formed about 10,000 years ago, and these wastes are going to be dangerous, they say, for hundreds of thousands of years. But if you actually look at it, this idea of being dangerous for hundreds of thousands of years has to do with plutonium, among other things. Plutonium is one of them. Plutonium has a half-life of 24,000 years. So 24,000 years, that's already twice as long as the Great Lakes have existed. And a half-life just means that you get that half of it will disintegrate in 24,000 years. You need another 24,000 years for another half of what remains to disintegrate. So then you still have a quarter of it left. And then you have to wait another 24,000 years. If you wait 10 times 24,000 years, you get 240,000 years. So that's why they say hundreds of thousands of years. It's based on things like plutonium. But what they don't tell you, and this is where the mystification comes in, is that when plutonium atoms disintegrate, they do not disappear. They change into another radioactive material, which has a half-life of 700 million years. So we're talking really about eternity. I mean, for all practical purposes, we're talking about eternity. There's a wonderful film made about the high-level waste in Finland called Into Eternity, which is highly recommended for people. It's a very thoughtful film. Because we have created a waste which is beyond the capability of science to predict how we can manage this stuff. And it's essentially indestructible material. Its atoms cannot easily be destroyed. If you could put them somehow magically into the center of the sun, they could be destroyed. But we don't know how to do that safely. So we have an industry which is creating problems, waste, which will remain dangerous for millions of years longer than the nuclear reactors that created them. And that just seems, on the face of it, crazy. Now, for the first 30 years of the nuclear industry, the industry pretended that there was no such thing as nuclear waste. They simply described nuclear power as an essentially clean and safe technology. And people who did not know any better, including myself, who, even though I had a degree in math, physics, and chemistry, with a gold medal in mathematics and physics, I didn't even know that nuclear waste existed, because nobody told me that it did. And I was told in high school, and I believed it, that nuclear power was safe and clean, meaning that, I suppose, it had no waste products. On the contrary, nuclear power creates the most dangerous and enduring waste byproduct of any industry ever conceived on Earth. So this is the real problem, is that we have people in charge of this waste whose real heart's wish is to perpetuate the industry. They're not so interested in cleaning up the waste. They don't consider themselves to be garbage men. They consider themselves to be nuclear scientists and engineers who are on a crusade to build as many nuclear reactors and nuclear facilities as they can and to infiltrate into every corner of the globe with this technology, because that's what excites them. What we need is people who are dedicated only to protecting the environment and protecting human health. These are the people who should be looking after the nuclear waste. And we believe that there are certain principles that should be laid down regarding these wastes. Number one, they should be monitored all the time. They should be constantly monitored. Number two, they should be retrievable. The reason for that is that when they start to leak, as they surely will, we should be able to get at the waste and repair any leaks that are taking place, and repackage the material into better packages as technology and knowledge advances. Number three, They should not be located near major water bodies because we are threatening the very lifeblood of the planet. Water is the lifeblood of all living things, and we shouldn't be threatening those in any way. No matter how safe it may seem in the short term, we know darn well that we can't guarantee that safety in the long term. Number four, we should have transferred the responsibility of this nuclear waste to an agency which is solely devoted to protection of the environment and protection of human health, and not in any way connected to the expansion of the nuclear industry. And finally, number four, we should have good education, demystification of the nature of these wastes, and make sure that the inventory of waste is very well understood, so that when future generations run into problems, they are not going to be left high and dry, not even knowing what the stuff is or how to deal with it.
One more point about the Bruce site and OPG's plan to build the deep nuclear waste repository. There are currently 227 resolutions that have been passed by cities, towns, provinces, states around the Great Lakes protesting the creation of this repository, as well as there have been scientists from around the world speaking out against it. What, if anything, will it take for the powers behind it to listen?
That's a good question. It's really a question of whether the government belongs to the nuclear industry or belongs to the people. If it's really government of the people, by the people, for the people, which is an American slogan, but it's the essence of democracy, isn't it? The essence of democracy is that people should be able to determine their own future and to protect themselves against undue harm. So I think it's a fundamental human right. The difficulty is that both in the United States and in Canada, and I would venture to say in virtually every other country that has a major nuclear industry, the nuclear industry operates like a state within a state. They are not really subject to the normal checks and balances. The people who are running the show, they are appointed but not elected, and they're not responsible to the electorate. And the government finds it convenient to simply delegate, I would say not just delegate, but really abdicate responsibility. They abdicate the responsibility to the nuclear industry so that, in effect, the nuclear industry is running the show, not the government. Now, I'm not saying that the government is all-knowing or anything, but if we have a government which is responsible to human needs and which is responsive to human needs, then we have to, in the age of nuclear waste, we have to insist on taking control of the future. The future cannot be dictated by the carelessness and convenience of the nuclear industry. It has to be looked after by people who have an ongoing concern for their grandchildren and great-grandchildren for many, many generations to come, countless generations to come. And that's not the nuclear industry. They're not the ones. They're the wrong people to be in charge.
Let's return to the question of Chalk River. We spoke before about the Chalk River radioactive waste mega dump, but there are also plans currently in place, and I believe being enacted already, to truck liquid radioactive waste over surface roadways from Chalk River, which is north of Ottawa, to the Savannah River site in South Carolina. And that means it has to go on surface highways through a minimum of 6 states. What is the nature of this liquid radioactive material, and has anything like this ever been attempted before?
Well, that's a very good question, and of course, it's another situation where the industry is operating for its own convenience and not in the best interest, perhaps, of the public. First of all, what is this stuff? Essentially, it's a radioactive fuel that has been dissolved in nitric acid, as I mentioned earlier. When they want to get plutonium for bombs, they irradiate the fuel in a reactor, and people may not understand, but there's two things that happen to the fuel in the reactor. One is that the atoms are broken apart by neutrons, and the broken pieces of the uranium atoms are hundreds of varieties of these broken pieces, these broken fragments. They're called fission products, and these fission products are intensely radioactive, so radioactive that we have it here in Canada, we have fuel bundles which are about the size of a fireplace log. One of those fuel bundles would kill any human being within 20 seconds at a distance of 1 meter just by the blast of gamma radiation that comes off it from the fission products that are created in the reactor. So these fission products are really nasty, very, very radioactive, and very dangerous. But there's something else that happens as well. Some of the uranium atoms in the fuel do not split, but in fact become heavier. And they become heavier by absorbing neutrons and be turned into a new element called plutonium. Plutonium is actually only one of about 36 new substances which are heavier than uranium. They're called transuranic elements. And there's plutonium, americium, there's curium, there's einsteinium, there's neptunium. There's a whole panoply of these, the most significant of which is plutonium because it's used for bombs. Now, these materials typically have half-lives measured in the thousands or tens of thousands or even millions of years, and that's where you get the very, very long-term hazard from the radioactive waste. Well, okay, so what you do is when you dissolve the fuel in nitric acid, all of those things are turned into a liquid solution. So you have a liquid solution containing an enormous variety of radioactive materials, which are very nasty in various ways, all of which are poisonous to all living things. That's the liquid that they want to transport. There's 23,000 liters of this. Now, you might say, well, did this come from plutonium production? Actually, no. It came from the production of medical isotopes. There's a medical isotope that's used in hospitals around the world called technetium-99m, and it's produced by the decay of a substance called molybdenum-99, and that's one of the fission products, only one of the hundreds of fission products. So here's what they do at Chalk River. Step number one, they buy weapons-grade uranium from the United States. Weapons-grade uranium, the same stuff that was in the Hiroshima bomb, very, very dangerous material that can easily be used in a very low-tech, powerful atomic bomb. They purchase this from the United States, and it's trucked up to Canada in a solid form. In Canada, it is converted into what they call targets. These targets are then put into the NRU reactor at Chalk River, and the highly enriched uranium undergoes fission and produces all those fission products and transuranic materials that I was telling you about. When the targets are taken out, they are dissolved in nitric acid, and they separate out the one little component that they're after, which is molybdenum-99, and all the rest of that junk is in the liquid waste. And they have a tank called the Fist Tank at Chalk River, which is a double-walled steel tank that has to be constantly monitored for temperature because it generates heat, and it has to be stirred because otherwise you could get what's called a criticality accident, an accidental nuclear chain reaction, which would be very devastating. And it also has to be carefully monitored for basically leakage, of course, and that sort of thing. So this is the stuff that they want to ship down to Savannah River site in North Carolina. Why? Why would they want to ship it all that distance, as you say, through all these states, along public roads? I did a calculation. I'm a mathematician by training. It turns out that if you look at the water supply of Washington, D.C., just as an example, Washington, D.C. has a reservoir called the Georgetown Reservoir, which contains 530 million liters of water. That's the drinking water supply for Washington, D.C. If you stirred in 2 ounces of this liquid material, it would be enough to contaminate that entire reservoir. That entire reservoir would become undrinkable according to EPA standards. It would exceed the permissible levels for all the radionuclides that are contained in it.
So why in the world is this waste being shipped back to the United States, and what makes it necessary for that to happen?
First point, it's not necessary. Second point, it's convenient. It's convenient for Canada to ship it out rather than having to deal with it. And it's convenient for the Savannah River people, who are, again, a private company that manages the only reprocessing plant left operating in the United States of America called the H Canyon. The H Canyon is the only operating reprocessing plant, and they don't have any business anymore because they have not been making plutonium for bombs for quite a while. So they need to have business in order to keep the profits rolling in and to keep people working at this facility. And this liquid material from Chalk River would justify them to keep operating this facility at least for the next 10 years, let's say.
So this is not based on any pre-existing agreement between the United States and Canada that, well, we'll give you this uranium, but at the end you have to send us back all the waste products so we can make money off of it.
No, and in fact, that's putting it a little bit too simply, because there is a sort of a semi-legitimate security concern. The security concern is based on the fact that, as I mentioned, highly enriched uranium, weapons-grade uranium, can easily be used to make an atomic bomb, although it's very difficult to get it out of the liquid solution. It's not an easy thing to get it out of the liquid solution. However, once you have separated highly enriched uranium, you can make a powerful atomic bomb with this. So there is a policy of the United States to try and take this material that has been sent out around the world to different facilities and repatriate it, that is, bring it back to the United States, or at least have the highly enriched uranium destroyed so that it cannot be used for weapons. Well, Indonesia is one of the countries that, in fact, received some of this weapons-grade uranium from the United States, and they also converted it into a liquid form, exactly as we did at Chalk River. And they asked permission in 2016 from the U.S. Department of Energy that would it be okay if we just destroy this stuff on site? And they said, sure, go ahead. And so what they did was they used a process called downblending in Indonesia. It only took them 3 months to do it. And they downblended all of their highly enriched uranium liquid in such a way that the material was degraded from highly enriched to low enriched uranium, which cannot be used for bombs. And the DOE said, perfect, no problem, you're out of our radar, you're off our radar system. Now, the same thing could be done at Canada, at Chalk River, and in fact, that was what the plan was. The plan was to downblend all of the contents of this tank at Chalk River, and then to solidify the material so that it would be no longer in liquid form and would also no longer be weapons usable. All of that can be done on site, and in fact was planned to be done on site. However, somewhere around 2012, the Obama administration had already arranged that we should get rid of this highly enriched uranium stuff that's floating around the world as a security risk. But somewhere along the line in 2012, an agreement was made with the Savannah River site people and the Chalk River people. Why don't you send it down here and we'll handle it? So this shipment is a matter of convenience for the industry. It's not a necessity.
Haven't there been a few trucking accidents carrying not radioactive waste, but certainly toxic materials that have been occurring on highways that raise the question, what if one of these trucks carrying the highly radioactive waste gets into an accident while trying to reach the Savannah River site?
Certainly there have. Just within the last calendar year, there was a huge accident involving 14 tractor-trailer trucks right by the Thousand Island Bridge that goes from Canada to the United States along the Highway 401, we call it, part of the Trans-Canada Highway. And one of these trucks was carrying a highly toxic liquid chemical that leaked out, and there were, I believe, something like 35 people that had to be decontaminated, including 15 first responders who had to be taken to the hospital and decontaminated because of this toxic liquid that leaked out of this massive pileup of transport trucks. Twisted metal galore is quite a sight. So that's one incident that occurred. Now, had that been liquid radioactive waste from Chalk River, they would have had to not only decontaminate people as best they could. It's almost impossible to decontaminate people, by the way, with this material. But they would probably have had to not only close the road as they did for a few days, they would probably have had to close that road for a very long period of time and even dig it up and bury it as radioactive waste, the road itself. That's what they had to do at Chalk River when they had that, I told you about that nuclear accident that took place in 1952. When they carried the damaged core of the reactor by truck along a roadway, some of the material leaked onto the roadway, and they had to dig up the roadway and bury that as radioactive waste. They probably would have had to do the same thing here. But worst of all would have been that it would almost surely have run into Lake Ontario. It's right close to the lake there. And had it run into Lake Ontario, it has the power. 1 liter is more than enough to contaminate the water supply of any city in North America. So it's a large amount of radioactive material, very long-lived. And once it's in the environment, you can't get it back out again.
So is this shipping going on now, and is there any way to stop it?
The first shipment apparently arrived in April at Savannah River site, and there may have been a second shipment, I don't know for sure, but there certainly has been a first shipment that has arrived at the Savannah River site at the H Canyon. I have a slideshow that anybody can access on our website, which is www.ccnr.org, and you can consult this slideshow. It shows pictures of the shipment arriving at the Savannah River site, and it shows the workers, when the workers extracted the bottles of liquid, steel bottles, they had to use long poles so that they didn't get too close to it, otherwise they would get overdosed with gamma radiation. And even using these long poles, the gamma radiation at one spot on the container was so high that it would overdose any of the workers. So they turned that spot to the wall so that it wouldn't irradiate people, and they managed to relatively safely unload it. But the fact that it was leaking like that when it arrived indicates that even as it's traveling along the road, the driver has separated from the load so as not to get overdosed too much with gamma radiation. But anybody caught in traffic besides such a truck would be receiving gamma radiation and neutron radiation, both of which cannot be 100% stopped. So if there's any fault in the shielding, there's shielding right into the container itself to try and block most of the gamma radiation, most of the neutron radiation. But if that shielding slips or is defective in some way, then people could get rather large doses even during normal transport. Leakage, of course, is far worse.
Is there any way to stop or hit the pause button on these shipments so that maybe something better can be figured out or implemented?
Well, we know what is better. What is better is to denature the stuff on-site, to downblend it on-site, and to solidify it on-site, which, by the way, they've been doing at Chalk River for the last 14 years. This tank was full in the year 2003, and in the intervening 14 years, they have continued to produce this liquid waste, but because the tank is full, they have been solidifying it as it's produced. So they know how to solidify it, and they know how to downblend it, and there's no necessity for this to be transported at all. So it's simply a question of a large enough chorus of voices to come forward to insist that these kind of shipments should not be allowed. And in fact, that in the age of nuclear waste, people have to take charge of this. You asked me before whether this liquid waste has ever been transported before, and the answer is never. It has never been transported over public roads. This is the first time ever. Even the shipping container they're using was designed 30 years ago only to handle solid radioactive fuel rods, and only one or two of them maximum, or a few individual fuel pins at a time. It was never designed to carry radioactive liquid. Of course, radioactive irradiated fuel is also extremely dangerous. However, if it's in solid form, you can more easily scoop it back up again by remote control and put it into a very heavily shielded container and retrieve the material. In the case of liquid, this cannot be done, and this is probably why never before have they ever considered moving this stuff over public roads.
What, if anything, is the nature of the protest that is going on against this and any kind of pressure being brought to bear on either Canada or if we can do it here in the United States to stop this current piece of nuclear insanity?
That's a good question. The difficulty is that we have a policy vacuum. There isn't really in Canada, for example. We do have a policy regarding high-level waste. It's a misguided policy, as it turns out. The high-level waste is the irradiated fuel itself, which is by far the most radioactive material of all. But we do not have any policy in Canada regarding low and intermediate level waste. It's a policy vacuum. And we also don't have any policy regarding, adequate policy at least, regarding the transport of radioactive waste as opposed to the transport of radioactive materials. The industry likes to argue, well, we transport radioactive materials all the time, for example, medical isotopes and so on. However, when you're transporting medical isotopes, it's generally just one radioactive material involved, and it's generally in a solid form. Although there are a few liquids that are transported, they're not highly radioactive liquids. things like heavy water that's contaminated with tritium. It's not the same thing as this highly radioactive stuff. But when they're transporting these materials, they know exactly what's in the package and they know exactly what they're dealing with. In the case of this liquid waste, as I mentioned, there's hundreds of different materials. It's like a witch's brew of radioactive materials. You're not dealing with just one stuff. You're dealing with a messy soup of radioactive materials. And the first responders, I gave a talk to first responders and elected representatives in the Niagara Peninsula just a couple of weeks ago. They have no idea how to react in the case of an accident.
I don't think anybody knows how to react in the case of an accident, so that they pretend that it's not going to happen until it actually does.
Right. And all I can say is that it's important for people to realize that it's now or never that one takes charge of the future. I think ultimately in a democracy, the popular voice, when it's well informed, should and often does prevail. People sometimes forget. It was only around 1970 that environment departments were created in the first place. And the only reason they were created was because of millions of people all over the world who were marching and mobilizing and insisting that the environment needed to be protected. So when you talk about global issues such as protection of the environment, such as women's rights, such as human rights, such as anti-war movements and so on, when you talk about really global issues, the leadership comes from the grassroots, and the people in government are the last ones to know. But eventually they get the message, and eventually they act, if the voices are loud enough. So that's what we really need to do at this point in time. We have to clamor for a more precautionary approach and to not allow the nuclear industry to make these huge decisions affecting some of our most important precious water bodies, like the Great Lakes, only for their own convenience.
Dr. Gordon Edwards, it's always stunning to talk with you for the breadth and the depth and the completeness of your information. And I know the listeners have learned a tremendous amount today, as have I. And I thank you so much for joining us today on Nuclear Hot Seat.
My pleasure, Libby.
Dr. Gordon Edwards of Canadian Coalition for Nuclear Responsibility, CCNR.org. In a follow-up email, Dr. Edwards wanted me to let you know that during the interview, he forgot to say that Canada has ceased the production of medical isotopes using reactors. Medical isotopes can be produced without uranium or reactors and without creating high-level radioactive wastes. We'll have some links that he sent up on the website. The first is to his June 2017 slideshow on the transport of highly radioactive liquid waste from Chalk River, Ontario, to the Savannah River site, a slideshow that was aimed at first responders, medical professionals, and elected officials. Terrific information there. And there will also be a link to his YouTube video of an online webinar he did on the Chalk River liquid waste in February of 2017. These links will be up on nuclearhotseat.com under this episode, number 317. Activist shout out! Brava, bravo, and thank you to Hervé Courtois for sorting out the specifics and crunching the numbers on the Japan TEPCO rad waste release story. Hervé writes for nuclear-news.net and also has his own blog, deunrenard.wordpress.com. He went back to the TEPCO source documents to sort out the confusions that I was telling you about. These are monthly reports that TEPCO puts out, which are core information, and that's how he uncovered the media's echo chamber of mistakes on the numbers, allowing me to give you accurate information. This deep research and insistence on absolute verifiable facts is why the two sites I just cited, nuclear-news.net and the blog, are primary go-to places when I want reliable information, especially on Japan. I also wish to acknowledge Sean McGee of nuclear-news.net and Nancy Faust of simplyinfo.org, who also provided clarifying information. My thanks to the three of you for understanding the numbers and helping me get it right. And Tim Judson of NIRS, Nuclear Information Resource Service, has put out the call for us to contact our U.S. representatives now to vote no on a nuclear waste bill being rushed through Congress. And he says that this is one of the most dangerous that he has ever seen. U.S. Representative John Shimkus of Illinois has introduced House Resolution 3053, the Nuclear Waste Policy Amendments Act of 2017. This bill would launch thousands of shipments of the deadliest radioactive nuclear waste ever made via truck, train, and/or barge shipments through 45 states, including through the hearts of many major cities and our precious farmlands, all of it headed for Yucca Mountain, Nevada, and supposedly interim parking lot dumps. Yeah, define interim. These shipments would pass through 370 of the 435 congressional districts across the U.S. So if you're in the United States, you're undoubtedly going to be impacted by this. The bill aims to revive the canceled, unsuitable, unsustainable Yucca Mountain nuclear waste dump, which is located on sacred Native American land, is incapable of isolating nuclear waste, and is located on high-risk earthquake fault lines and vital water systems. We need to contact our representatives now, this month, July of 2017, before Congress breaks for the August recess. The goal is to prevent H.R. 3053 from ever hitting the House floor. So contact your congressional representative and tell her or him to vote no. Here's today's final thought. The longer I produce Nuclear Hot Seat, and we're in our seventh year now, the more I realize that mainstream media is mostly incompetent when it comes to understanding the complexity of nuclear issues. Talking points, passing along the nuclear industry's well-massaged languaging without challenge, incorrect numbers, as you heard today. It seems that if they don't consult with activists to get the story straight, they run the risk of echo chambering incorrect information, misplaced talking points, or just missing the story altogether. Last week, I attended an event put on by five different journalism organizations. It was a mixer, and the venue was packed with recent journalism grads desperately looking for job leads, experienced mid-career TV producers desperately looking for job leads, and grizzled veterans hoping to hold on to their current jobs long enough to land a retirement package, knowing that the job they leave will not be filled by anyone. The event took place only 4 days after the UN passed the Nuclear Prohibition Treaty on July 7, 2017. So I conducted a little experiment. To reporters and wannabes of all ages and levels of experience, I asked, "Do you know what happened of a nuclear nature last Friday at the United Nations?" Not a single person, reporter, news professional knew. And only one, when I revealed the magnitude of the event that has the potential to turn around international nuclear proliferation, something which impacts every woman, man, and child on the planet, only one of them shook his head in recognition and said, "Wait a minute, I think I did hear something about it." But he wasn't sure what he had heard. There's an old saw. If a tree falls in the woods and there's no one around to hear, did it make any sound? So I ask, if a nuclear prohibition treaty gets passed by the United Nations and mainstream media does not pick it up, did it happen? Hell yeah, it happened. Now it's up to all of us to find ways to work it into the national conversation, especially here in the United States, where it was all but blackballed out of mainstream media. That's why we need to keep talking about the UN's actions, the new Nuclear Prohibition Treaty, or NPT. It's on us, so listen up. Write letters to the editor. Post information on social media and include the URLs icanw.org, the International Campaign to Abolish Nuclear Weapons, and don'tbankonthebomb.com. Post about it, Then take your outraged Facebook posts and turn them into comments on news articles that you send to the publications, the reporters who wrote the articles you are protesting, to the editors over the reporters. We have just made a huge international breakthrough in the legality and perception of nuclear weapons. It's a powerful crowbar with which to leverage the policy of nations from support of or neutrality towards nuclear weapons to downright opposition, as it is now encoded in international law. This is the chance of a lifetime to make certain that we all do have a lifetime. So let's make a lot of noise and not stop until nuclear weapons are a thing of the past. As my mother would say, we should all live that long. This has been Nuclear Hot Seat for Tuesday, July 18, 2017. Material for this week's program has been researched and compiled from deunrenard.wordpress.com, nuclear-news.net, nuknet.org, enenews.com, japantoday.com, sputniknews.com, japantimes.co.jp, itworld.com, nature.com, thinkprogress.org, stlouis.cbslocal.com, denverpost.com, durangoherald.com, miamiherald.com, miningawareness.wordpress.com, wjbf.com, standard.co.uk, theecologist.org, ipswichstar.co.uk, theguardian.com, gizmodo.com, livemint.com, Nuclear Information and Resource Service, or NIRS.org, Canadian Coalition for Nuclear Responsibility, U.S. Nuclear Regulatory Commission event reports, and a shout-out to the Nuclear Hot Seat listeners and followers for your awareness, your support, and your love of this planet. With thanks for gathering and giving your likes to the Nuclear Hot Seat blog site on Facebook. Theme music written by me, sung by Marilee Weber, accompaniment by John Barnard, recorded at Winslow Court Studio in Hollywood. If you have a story lead, a hot tip, or a suggestion of someone to interview, send an email to info@nuclearhotseat.com. We are copyright 2017, Libby Halevy and Hardestry Communications. All rights reserved, but fair use allowed as long as proper attribution is provided. And a reminder that if you appreciate weekly verifiable news updates about nuclear issues around the world, delivered with as much humor as possible, take a moment to send a supporting donation to nuclearhotseat.com. This is Libby Halevy of Hardestry Communications, the heart of the art of communicating, reminding you that the cure for global warming is not nuclear winter, or nuclear autumn, or any other nuclear season. There, you've all had your nuclear wake-up call. Now, don't go back to sleep, because we are all in the nuclear hot seat.
Nuclear hot seat. What are those people thinking? Nuclear hot seat. What have those boys been drinking? Nuclear hot seat. The corium is sinking. Our time to act is shrinking, but our activists are linking. Nuclear hot seat. It's da bomb.